You're very welcome to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast. I'm your host, Shane Darby. In this episode, we're going to take a look at the history of the County Sligo Golf Club with Tony Cunningham, who is a long-standing member of the club with a keen interest and knowledge of the history since its founding in 1894. He joins us for a chat about the origins of the club, some of its founding fathers, the development of the links, the beginnings of the West of Ireland Championship, and indeed some stories about some of the multiple winners to lift the trophy. Tony was very kind with his time when I was at the club recently. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Many thanks for tuning in. Tony Cunningham, how are you?
That's right. I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you very much for giving us some time today. And
no problem.
To try and learn a little bit more about the history of County Sligo Golf Club.
Fine.
So, I believe, and thank you for your time recently, I believe there's some story in terms of the origin story with regard to the Sligo Militia. What can you tell us about the founding fathers from 1894?
From 1894, the Connacht Rangers and the Sligo Militia had a camp on the headland of Beaumore, down beside the beach. There were eight cannons on that hill. Sadly, there's none of them today. Three of them are still survive, one in Strandhill and two at a house of what the place called Grange North in Sligo. It was a man that had bought these two cannons. There were two other cannons, very large cannons, that lasted until the 1950s. And unfortunately, for some reason, they were taken away and scrapped. There was three regiments in Ireland, the Sligo Artillery, the Connacht Rangers, and the Clare Regiment. And they were the only artillery regiments in Ireland. And they came, even the Clare Regiment came here to Sligo, and they were all on the hill, as we call it, Beaumore Point. And they used to practice shooting at the sea. But as WBC, we think it was WBA, said, there was one battle they could never win against the waves. But there's a number of areas on the course and that named after the Connacht Rangers. Now, Colonel Campbell was in Sligo. He was a businessman in Sligo. James Campbell. And he was a part of the Sligo Militia. And we reckon that before 1894, that he and some of the army officers used to play golf. And in that time, and the reason I say this is because the Clare Regiment came here in, they told me 1902, and it definitely wasn't 1902. It had to be before 1894, was because they camped up there on the first fairway. There was three holes crossing that after 1894. So it definitely was before that time.
Okay.
And he was, as I say, a businessman in here in Sligo. He got a George Coombe to come here, and he designed the first nine holes here.
And Coombe, of course, has connections with Roy County Down. He's connections with Roy County Down, I believe.
That's right. He was connection with Roy County Down. He was secretary there for many years. He was a fine golfer, and he was also the first secretary of the Golfing Union of Ireland. He designed the holes in conjunction with Colonel Campbell, and Colonel Campbell brought his some of the people that worked for him out here to build the greens and that. Now, the first nine holes were up on the plateau here. The first tee was opposite the hotel down there, because his clubhouse wasn't here, and up to the in front of the watch house. Now, the watch house, of course, wasn't there at the time. That watch house wasn't built there till 1902. And the second hole went out towards the beach out there. And then the third one went down onto the hill at Beaumore. Now, an interesting point on the hill at Beaumore, in connection with the Connacht Rangers, we discovered, there's a hill there beside it, and they call it Peter's Hill. But it wasn't P-E-T-E-R, it was P-I-E-T-E-R. And it came from the Connacht Rangers, who had fought in the Boer War, and had fought in Natal in South Africa. And the valley beside it, running up to the 17th green, they called that the Tegela. But Peter's Hill in the Tal was beside the Tegela River. And this is where it came from.
Okay.
Now, you got any more on that?
No, I mean, I think probably my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, so in 1907, the course was extended to 18 holes by Colonel Campbell's brother, James.
That's correct.
Sorry, beg your pardon. Colonel Campbell's brother, William.
William, that's correct.
And that was designed in a clockwise routing, yeah?
A clockwise, yeah. Mm-hmm. He kept the first four holes here on this section. It went out to the fourth. And then the fifth hole headed down to the back of our 16th green, currently our 16th green. Mm-hmm. The holes cut from there right over to where the tees are at the 15th green. There's a little valley in front of the 15th tee. The sixth hole was there. The seventh hole then crossed over the stream over onto the, which is now the eighth fairway. They went from there up to the ninth, on the fairway, just below, in front of the ninth tee. Then the 12th and 13th holes, which today are still being played, they were designed by Colonel Campbell.
Okay.
They're Campbell holes. Now, they'll be extensively changed, particularly the 12th. The tee is extended away back, and there's a new green being built there. The new green was built in 1995.
Okay.
The 13th hole, there's been changes there with bunkers and that, and move the tee back further. But there were two Campbell holes. He came back from there then, back to where the sixth green is now. And there's two holes from there. And then the old green there's an old green at the fifth, under the fifth tee, still there. You can see it, actually, the shape of it. And then they came back up onto the top of the hill here. And one went up to near the second hole now. The next hole came down, and then there was three holes there where the cottages, of course, weren't there at the time, crossing over where the first fairway is now. The fourth hole, interestingly, that still exists to a certain extent. In 2019, when the club was 75 years old, or 125 years old, Porikina and myself went out and found the old tee on top of what we call Peter's Hill, and we cut the old tee. And the hole was played across the valley to the present fourth green, or just short of the fourth green.
Okay.
In front, on the left-hand side of the fourth green, there's an old grass bunker. Mm-hmm. That was part of the original course.
Okay.
And the green was beside it.
Okay.
Now, it was a very short hole. We were surprised how short it was.
Okay.
And it's not until you play it. And it was an easy par four. But then we must remember
Hickory.
What equipment they were
Hickory
using
and gutta percha and maybe the odd Haskell as well, yeah. At a later stage, yeah?
Colonel Campbell, or Colonel Willie Campbell, was the first international golfer to play out of here.
Uh-huh.
He played for us in 1906.
Okay.
And I'll tell you an interesting thing, and it came actually from Brendan Cashel, who has written a wonderful book on the West of Ireland Golf Championship. And we were here in 2017, and we always played a biennial match with Portmarnock. And we were saying that it was the 50th year of playing the match against Portmarnock.
Mm-hmm.
And Brendan said, "You're incorrect," he said. "The first match between Portmarnock and Ross's Point was played in 1907.
Wow.
And on the day that they played here in 1907, they opened the new nine holes designed by Willie Campbell. And on that same day, Colonel Campbell presented a cup to the club here called the Hermitage Cup,
mm-hmm.
in 1907. And it was played twice a year from then on, but it's still played at the moment. And people often say to me, why was it called the Hermitage Cup? And the answer was simple. That was the name of his house. And he and Arthur Jackson Sr., and his nephew, Campbell Perry, they were the three men who really started and drove this place.
Uh-huh.
How much golf the three of them played, we don't know. We don't think they were great golfers. But I think it was something they wanted to push at the time. A thing of interest, what I've often noticed, is that Arthur Jackson was a very far-seeing man. He actually had ladies members from the first day. And we have a cup there. It's from 1904, the Jackson Cup for ladies. And we feel it's one of the first cups for an open ladies competition in Ireland. It's a beautiful cup. Yeah. But he himself was a great golfer, but it gives you an indication of how he wanted the ladies to play. And an interesting point, the first lady captain here in 1925 was his daughter, Olive Jackson. And his family had a huge connection. His son, Arthur Jr., he started the West of Ireland, which is in Brenda's book.
Of course. Well, that was obviously 1923, if I'm right.
That's 23.
But before we get on to that, just a little something on William Campbell, obviously, that you mentioned just a minute ago. Needless to say, ironically, a Royal Dublin connection also.
He had.
Yeah. Insofar as he was captain in 1914, Royal Dublin.
Correct.
Immediately before the outbreak of World War One.
Yeah.
And actually, the 12th hole, the par 3 in Royal Dublin, is called after him. And I believe that he was somewhat responsible for the design of that hole.
Well, that's very interesting.
There you go.
And I'll tell you the interesting point about that is that he was a barrister, Willie Camp.
Yeah. Trinity educated.
That's right.
University, yeah.
But we get the impression that he was at college with Harry Court.
Okay.
I can't remember now where it was exactly.
Oxford?
But Oxford, yeah. That's right. And when they decided to extend the links here and bring Court in the Cawthrey was actually appointed originally. But Cawthrey couldn't come here at the time. And they decided they would look elsewhere. Harry Court was in working in Royal Portrush at the time. And there were some complications that happened in Portrush. And Willie Campbell decided to go to Portrush to see what Corrie Court came here. Mm-hmm. And Court came here because he hadn't had work at the time. And the interesting thing is the fee that was agreed with Hawthorne was 50 guineas and they agreed a fee of 40 guineas with Colt.
That's, of course, Martin's granddad, yeah?
That's right.
So Martin's the existing one before. So is it Fred or is it the other one?
It was Fred Hawthorne, who was the father. Yeah. Martin was the grandson.
Yeah.
That's right. But, yeah. But he, that was 1927. Now, Colt went the opposite way. These all olds now are all home.
Anti-clockwise, yeah.
Anti-clockwise. And he had a habit, called of shooting one side. We went out as far as the sixth and suddenly we shoot to the seventh. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of changes, I remember being on the seventh hole it was 20 years ago when I was captain here with Martin Hawthorne. And he's pointed to the left-hand side, the right-hand side. He said, Harry Court, he said, never put the bunker there. He said, on that course there. He says, they were on the left-hand side. And I said, to where? There was three bunkers there, but there was only one of them left at the time. So there was a lot of the little changes like that. And there was two bunkers at the eighth hole. You see on the eighth hole, there's a little hill. There was two like spectacle bunkers in that. And of course, the reason they were taken out was when the course was designed, the members couldn't reach it.
Okay.
But as time moves on, they could reach it easily.
But my understanding, if I'm correct, Tony, Colt obviously designed the routing and did Charles Allison come back to bunker it, yeah?
Charles Allison designed the bunkers because I believe sometime after Colt finished, he had to go back to Portmarnock, so he didn't get shined. Charles Allison came here and he designed the bunkers.
Okay.
That's what we reckon.
I believe at the time, from a time perspective, it was often common. I know Mackenzie did it in Royal. Mackenzie, when he was in Sydney designing New South Wales, when he did the routing, first of all, in 26, he basically just did the routing, okay, and said, there's the green, this is where the fairway should go. And he didn't see any of the holes essentially built, but basically suggested, look, hang on, don't bunker it now. So give it a couple of years and just put bunkers where people put their tee shots. So it was actually commonplace, if you like, to have the design and the routing done, get it built, and then do the bunkering afterwards.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's what we reckon here.
Yeah.
The one thing that we have not been able to verify, and there's a small piece in the minutes. There were some complications at the 17th when they were designing it, and we haven't been able to find out what it was. It was mentioned in it, in the minutes, but there was no reference to actually what it was.
Yeah.
And we, as I said, we would love to know what the problem was.
But interestingly, having seen your recent proposal that the members approved from Mackenzie and Ebert.
That's right.
There's a mention of the left-hand side of the 17th, that the depression there, and they're suggesting a recontouring. It, whatever is on the left-hand side of the green side on 17, they suggested was seen to be done pretty quickly. So if that may have something to do with the problem that they had on the 17th.
It more than likely was, yeah. And as you can appreciate, at the time, there wasn't the equipment,
of course,
the machinery. And as I said earlier on, that most of the work in the early days was carried out by Colonel Campbell's workmen.
Okay.
Now, that wouldn't have happened in 1928 because Colonel Campbell died in 1924.
Yeah. My understanding, obviously, in terms of Royal Port Rush, the contractor for that was Colt's preferred contractor, a company called Frank's Harris Brothers.
Yeah.
I was speaking to David Dunn towards the end of last week, and he thought that Frank's Harris may have been involved from a contracting perspective in setting the golf course, the Colt course, out. Is there any truth, or do you know anything about that?
No, that's something I don't know about.
Okay.
As I said, again, unfortunately, because of the minutes, and a lot of the minutes were vague and a lot of the minutes are missing.
Okay.
And we have been looking, because several people have asked me from time to time, various scenes, actually Brendan Cashel in particular, and I couldn't find the minute books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pity, because it was during the club renovations, and that little thing I gave to you there,
yeah,
was, it was taken out of the skip over here.
Okay.
And that's a lot of other information.
Well, whoever took that out did the club some service. But it would be lovely, and to be fair, I understand you've got a couple of original Colt routing plans.
We have
one in the bar here, and David has one as well, I believe.
There's a couple in there.
Okay, right
there.
Well, I must take some pictures of that.
And put them
up, if that's okay.
The day that Martin Hawtrey was here, in the afternoon,
Martin Ebert, yeah.
Yeah, this is Martin Hawtrey.
Oh, Hawtrey, beg your pardon.
This is the battle in 2001.
Okay.
Martin Hawtrey spent the whole afternoon looking at those drawings, of course. He was very interested in Colt himself and how we design things and all that. And as I said, we're lucky that we have those drawings.
Yeah.
It's great that we have them.
And just apropos the Colt heritage, Tony, how important do you think that is to the identity of the golf club?
It's extremely important, and it's become more important in recent years, because people seem to be going back to these designers, who they wear and what they wear.
Yeah.
And whilst a lot of them, they learned a lot of the design and that work from playing golf themselves. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Colt was secretary for many years in England.
Sunningdale,
It's quite an important thing to have it, but there is a society, the Colt Society.
There is,
and I don't know whether they're still in operation.
I think,
or not.
Obviously they were based in Stoke Park or Stoke Poges, as it used
That's
to
right,
be.
Stockport.
Interestingly, as an aside, Charles Allison, before he became a partner of Colt, was secretary of Stoke Poges.
Yeah,
and actually before that, he was secretary in Fox Rock in Dublin, would you believe?
Yeah.
But I suppose apropos the point about returning to the Golden Age principles, you know, for a long time post Second World War, you know, all of those designers like Colt and Fowler and Tom Simpson, and even the American designers, and obviously Mackenzie as well, the American guys like Tillinghast and Phones, et cetera, Charles Blair MacDonald and Seth Rayner, they were all starting to die, if you like.
Yeah.
And you know, the new broom after the Second World War and the boom of the American post World War II economy, it was very much sort of, what's the next big thing? You know, the 20s was only 20 years ago, and they had the depression in between, and they just wanted to forget about those times, and you know, everything American was bigger, longer, faster, flashier. Yeah. And I suppose when we think back on history, very much for the last week, while, you know, you could make an argument that European golf design was probably, there was a lag of 20 years or so from maybe a fashion perspective or a trend perspective. And I guess ever since Sand Hills in Nebraska, which Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw did in the mid-90s, there has been that movement back towards, I guess, back to the future, if you like, in terms of strategic golf design, interest, playability. That whole notion of a championship test has kind of changed a little bit.
It has.
It's more of a setup thing than actually bunker the shit out of it. Yeah. Excuse my French. So the great Bernard Darwin described Harry Cole's work at the Dunluce course as a monument more enduring than brass. Okay, it's a quote from Horace, the Greek philosopher, and very much, you know, I've been fortunate enough to visit County Sligo on a number of occasions, and this is probably my fourth or fifth time playing it today. Really looking forward to it. But for me, you know, Ross's point is one of the monuments of Irish links golf. It's a championship venue, how lucky are myself and Niall to be here today to share some time with you, but also to be, you know, to be in a place that's so important, you know, in terms of developing the game of golf in Connacht, and also, you know, farther afield in Ireland. I mean, we forget how small the golf space was back in the late 1880s or early 1890s, and the cross-pollination that there was across the board, be it, you know, Anthony Brutus Babington across Royal Dublin and Beaver Park and Port Rush and Royal Belfast and et cetera, et cetera. So it's no wonder that there's a link into Willie Campbell and Royal Dublin.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, obviously we mentioned that 1923 was the first staging in the West of Ireland. What do you know about what precipitated the creation and the setting up and the founding of the competition?
I think at the time that this was mainly through Arthur Jackson.
Okay.
Arthur Jackson Jr.
Yep.
Because he was quite a competent golfer himself. He was a very good swimmer, a very good sportsman, a very heavy man. And unfortunately, it caused his demise. But he was interested in, and at the time, they were beginning to develop the Connacht branch. There was no Connacht branch at the time.
Okay.
And he started the championship here, run by the club. And the following year, the Connacht branch was formed. And because of his connection with the golf here, he was made vice president of the Connacht branch on its inauguration in 1924. And to mark that occasion, he presented a cup, another Jackson's Cup for men. And it was open to all clubs in Connacht, and still is to this day. It's the major match play competition in this club. And an interesting thing to add to that on it is that next month, hopefully, his daughter is still alive in Belfast. She's 93 years of age and she still drives her own car, and she's very much involved. She's 45 years working for the RNLI. And I wrote to her before Easter there. I met her some time ago to come here, and we presented her with the book. So she said she probably would. And I'm hoping that she does. It is the one connection we have with the past. And as I said, she's been here a couple of times and had photographs taken with her father's cup and her grandfather's cup. But that's the one connection we have. But no, I think myself that that was actually the original origination of the competition. And I don't know whether you've been through Brendan's book or not.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's a fabulous book.
And is it for sale in the pro shop?
The amount of work that Brendan has done on that.
You had mentioned that. He's nothing. I've certainly seen his history of Portmarnock Golf Club.
He
published, was it last year or the year before?
That's right.
No stone was left unturned with that book. So I can imagine how all-encompassing the book on the West of Ireland Championship is.
Oh, it is, yeah. And I myself personally have learned a lot from it. I did a lot of work with Brendan when he was, he recognises that in the book as well, when he was writing the book. But when I saw the production at the finish,
yeah,
it's a fabulous book. And it's a great thing for this club.
You were happy and the members were happy and it's...
All the members were happy, yeah, very happy with yeah. it. And what one of the things that it does, and it's one of the things this course doesn't get credit for, is the views that you can get from this course. And the one thing in most of the photographs that stands out, and I suppose it's the most iconic part of Sligo, is Ben Bulben Mountain. Mm-hmm. To see it down at the 10th and yeah. see it in the background. Yeah. And it's great to see it. The other place that we have,
do you think we'll see it today? It's a bit foggy.
You may not see it today. I don't like where the forecast is going.
Okay.
The other place you get a lot of views is from the top of the second yeah. hole, right across. You get five counties.
You're
from
giving
it.
Niall's not played here before. You're giving away all the secrets. He now knows where the second reveal is.
But there's great. The one thing about this course, which is, you see everything in front of you. You see it as it is. There's nothing around the corners. Yeah. There's no blind shots, yeah. no blind holes. The only hole that there is slightly blind is the 18th.
Okay.
And the 18th hole is called Christie's Farm.
Okay.
The reason it's called Christie's Farm is because you're hitting your tee shot across the gully,
yeah.
which we knew as a Tegela. And this old guy, Christy Bellew, could not get across it.
Okay.
So he used to hit his tee shot across the 17th green, the back of it, to play up the hill. So there was another place on the left-hand side which we cut, and uh-huh. that was known as Toomey's Garden.
Okay.
And Des Toomey was another player. He couldn't reach it, so he had to play into this and then play off. Of course, they had the shots, but it was... That's where they got the name. Yeah.
In terms of just going back to the West of Ireland, I mean, I just was looking through the notable winners and moving backwards from both County Sligo and Royal Dublin. You loaned them to us. Yeah. Barry Anderson, obviously, was a winner quite recently. Great celebrations, not only in Dollymount, but also in Ross's Point, yeah. and well-deserved. Barry's a class act. People will obviously be aware of the names of Shane Lowry, Rory McIlroy, who actually defended as a 16-year-old,
that's
I believe,
right, yeah.
in 05 and 06. Going back a little bit farther, Padraig Harrington in 1994.
Yeah.
Not to mention, for all those people, the non-Irish out there, Harry Diamond, Rory's caddy, was West of Ireland champion in 2012. Yeah. He was some golfer and is some golfer in his own right. He people don't maybe quite understand how good he is and how good he was. And then getting into the meat of it, I mean, obviously John Burke, who would be of the parish of Lahinch, won six yeah. times.
Yeah,
JB, the great JB Carr, who I think in total won 28 or 29 senior amateur championships, including multiple. Obviously the West of Ireland Championship nine times, and then your own Cecil Ewing, who was a 10-time champion. What can you tell us about some of those gentlemen? I mean, particularly we maybe not forget about the most recents, but the likes of John Burke and JB Carr and Cecil. I mean, they are, you know, back in those days. I guess people may not realize how much more important the amateur game was when compared with the pro game.
Amateur game was very, very big. And actually, sadly, here in Sligo, in the West of Ireland Championship, never got the credit that was deserved to it. The people that we got credit from was actually the people who came here. And we have a cup there in the cabinet, the Visitor's Cup. It's this claret jug there. You probably see it beside me.
Yeah.
And that was given to the club in 1945 by Pierce Purcell and Arthur Hamilton. And they collected quite a lot of money for that. And for the first prize, they gave a silver salver, which was won by Jerry Owens. And the rest of the money then was for the competition during the year. But it was a thank you to the people of the club for the way they were entertained over the weekend, because it was a weekend's golf uh-huh. at the time.
Yeah.
Because not only was the West of Ireland played, on the Sunday they played for the O'Connor Cup. And sometimes on the Monday, then they played for the Connacht Bar Cup. But in latter times, then it became the Visitors' Cup they played for. But Cecil Ewing was our own. He was born and reared in the village here. Very big man, tall man, very fine golfer. And He was had a very, his swing was, I suppose, was what most people thought was very strange. He had a very short backswing. He only went to there. But when he was...
John Rahm-esque.
Yeah. When he was young, seemingly he had problems with his toes.
Okay.
And he found that he had an open swing at the time, that he found that it was hindering him, this toe. So he decided this stance, where he'd stand with his feet very close together, mm-hmm. and he'd only go to there. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I always remember about Cecil Ewing is, even in the wind, he could place the ball on the right-hand side or the left-hand side of the fairway. He was very good at where I saw it really was, one year at the 15th hole, we had a little bit of flooding on the left-hand side, and Cecil was well up the right-hand side, mm-hmm. well clear of the water.
Okay.
He could place the ball. He was a very, very good golfer, and he used to hit the ball very, very low, but it'd just rise.
Okay.
But he was a great man to play into the wind.
Okay.
And he and Carr were rivals here for years. Burke, I don't remember. Unfortunately, Burke was before my time.
Okay.
And even though I saw the first West of Ireland, I suppose, was about 1948. But Burke was before that time.
Okay.
And he came here quite a lot. And you probably know all the stories about Burke.
Well, I do, but maybe some of the listeners don't. So maybe you can tell me the story about John Burke and the Walker Cup, perhaps. I believe he represented Great Britain and Ireland once and once only.
He did. But the only thing story that I remember on Joe Burke being told here was putting his tee shot down at the 18th hole.
Uh-huh.
And he was watching his opponents and see what he was doing. They were watching him. And he took out a 3-iron, seemingly, and he put it on the green from there and went on to win.
Okay.
I can't remember who it was now, but that's the only story I heard about John Burke. But I'd hear the older guys talk.
My understanding that John Burke may have had Republican tendencies.
He had.
Yes.
From what I gather.
Correct. And he would have my understanding is he also represented Great Britain and Ireland in the Walker Cup only once.
Yes,
because
right.
The RNA were unaware of his Republican tendencies.
Yeah.
When they found out, he wasn't selected anymore. And also, another wee story, obviously Mackenzie would have revised the Lahinch golf course down in Lahinch.
Yeah.
And I believe Burke didn't like some of the hills and hummocks that Mackenzie put in the Mackenzie greens. So
yeah.
He flattened them.
Ooh.
Which is unfortunate because I also don't believe that Lahinch have any pictures of the Mackenzie greens from that mid-1920s perspective. So presumably you would have seen J.B. Carr as well then, so.
I've seen J.B. Carr a lot.
Yeah.
I always remember with J.B. Carr, and I was only very young at the time, was his putting was not okay. good
yeah.
at the time. And he decided to use a 3-iron. And I remember watching him that day use the 3-iron mm-hmm. to very great effect.
Wow.
So
the additional loft of the 3-iron was better for his putting stroke than perhaps
two
or 3 degrees. Yeah. I guess maybe just going, but before we finish up, Tony, and thank you very much for your time. I'm wondering, as Colt progressed in age, Alison would, of course, have gone off to the States and to Japan.
Yeah.
Colt stopped traveling, probably sort of before World War II. And would have passed over the travel element of the design practice, so anywhere outside England, to his other partner, John Morrison, at the time.
Yeah.
Are you aware of any involvement that Morrison had here?
No. I mean, we're none. Morrison's name was never mentioned, but I knew of the club. That's why I give you that. The three names are on that.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think at any stage that Morrison was here.
Okay.
And unfortunately, see, again, it goes back when we start looking for minutes. There's nothing in it, even though a lot of the minutes are very vague.
Okay.
Now, it's a pity that when you're here, I found a piece last night of taken from one of the minute books some time ago in connection with the 17th
uh-huh.
and the remarks about Cole. But there's nothing, we'll say, major in it.
Specific,
it's just what
general,
you mentioned about
general,
having the
general terms.
General
terms. So obviously after World War II or what we in Ireland here call the emergency.
Emergency, then.
You know, there probably wasn't a hell of a lot happening in relation to course revisions or anything like that. You know, it wasn't really until the 1960s that Eddie Hackett got a little bit of momentum. And was anybody like Hackett or I mean, obviously we know that Pat Riddy was involved here sort of in later days. From a course design perspective, was there anybody else involved in relation to overseeing the course or making suggestions? suggestions as to improvements that might be considered?
There was several people came along. From time to time, we got people writing in, agronomists writing in, course designers writing in. And in fact, here in 2001, we had a number of submissions. And at that stage, we decided to bring in Martin Hawtrey.
Okay.
That was to negate what was happening.
Okay.
There were a lot of people, say, from time to time over the years. Some of the members here tried different things, and
how did that work out?
It didn't. It was only a minor effect, you know. They wanted to change the second one time, and because certain people couldn't get up the hill,
okay,
and it changed the green. But the general membership always put a block, on that. They were very proud of the fact.
So good sense prevailed.
Good sense prevailed.
Okay.
Even when we built Beaumore here, we had an ex-captain who wrote to the club here telling it would be a white elephant, and how he proposed to make a different design of the course, which would mean altering the cold course. And I met him and we had quite an argument over it. But I said it was the difference between his opinion and the club opinion.
Yeah.
And we at the time went ahead and built Beaumore.
Yeah.
Which has been a great success.
And that's obviously your additional nine-hole golf course. What architect was involved with you for that?
The architect was, he was Tucker. I can't think of his first name. He was from STRI.
Okay.
And he designed the nine holes. Previous to that, I believe that Eddie Hackett had designed nine holes on Beaumore.
Okay.
But it never materialized.
Okay.
I don't know what happened. You hear it, it mightn't be even true, but I've been told that.
Okay.
But can't think of the man. Oh yes, I can't think of his first name, but he was the man who designed. They were the course agronomists here for us at the time.
Okay.
So we got him over, and he designed the nine holes on Beaumore.
Okay.
And it has been, as I say, a great success. There's a lot of people who have never played golf only for Beaumore.
Yeah.
And we're quite happy with it as a nine hole course. It has really matured over the years since we started it.
Yeah.
This three of the holes there as good as any hole on the championship
and it's
course.
Probably slightly more manageable in that it's kind of your traditional lowland plain, if you like, that it's laid out over.
Well, one of the great things about Beaumore is for elderly men like myself, it's level,
and women surely,
and the ladies the same, and we can walk from there, and there's a toilet beside it.
Okay.
And it's all within walkable distance.
Yeah.
And that has been the big success of Beaumore. The other one that has made a difference here in the late 80s, early 90s, the junior golf, they were always looking for time on a Saturday morning.
Uh-huh.
It's the only time the children were off
sure.
school. And of course, members did not want that.
Uh-huh.
And once with the addition of Beaumore, they could go to Beaumore.
Yeah.
It solved that problem.
Yeah.
And since that time, we've had a very, very good junior golf.
That's brilliant. But like it's funny, you know, that additional facility, whether it's a shorter course, it's more manageable, it's friendlier, it's kind of more, I guess, from a starting perspective, but also the other end of the spectrum.
That's right.
When the big course is a little bit too big,
yeah,
that it actually fulfills a number of different roles and routes to the game.
Does, yeah.
Or routes away from the game, if you like.
Yeah. Just thought of the man's name that designed it. It was Jonathan Tucker.
Okay.
Jonathan Tucker, that was the man's name.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for sharing your insight. As I said, we'll take a look at the drawing inside. And obviously, you said David has a slightly different map as well that he might be able to show me.
Yeah.
Listen, you're a gentleman. Thank you very much for your time.
You're
thanks
very
for sharing.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Just before we sign off, I have a wee little favour to ask. If you're enjoying the show, it would be great if you could give it a star rating and maybe even a written review on your particular podcast platform of choice. It really makes a difference and would be very much appreciated. Many thanks for considering the request. Until the next time, happy golfing.